My talk is a little bit away from the main topics because the equation I'm going to talk about are certainly variational, but not in the sense of elliptic equation or minimization problem. It's more like a hyperbolic equation with a variational origin. So these equations are the Bornfeld equations. And they go back to the 30s. And this is a nonlinear. It becomes to the setting of nonlinear Maxwell equations. And so the setting is the following. So you have an electromagnetic field, EB, depending on time and space. So here, X is in R3. And E and B have three components. And they are linked by the following constraints. So we have dTB plus the curl of E is 0. And the divergence of B is 0. OK. So now, in order to define the electromagnetism model, one way to do it is to introduce a Lagrangian density. And then you can define your favorite electromagnetic model by varying the time and space integral of the Lagrangian under the constraint. One, which is this set of equations. Okay? And so the most classical case, the standard case, is Maxwell, where the Lagrangian density is just B squared minus E squared over 2. Okay. So the BI case is a little bit more complicated because we have the funny following formula, which is minus square root of 1 plus b square minus e square. So here I should have put the opposite convention and minus e dot b square. So where does it come from? So the origin of this quantity, which looks a little bit mysterious, is not so mysterious if you consider the so-called electromagnetic tensor, which is made of the component of E and B, like this. So you have 0, E minus E1, minus E2. It's Q symmetric. And here we have B3, B2, B1, and with some sign. So I think it is correct like this. 2 minus B1. OK. So it's Q symmetric. And now we consider the metric tensor, which is natural in the framework of wave equation, which is a Minkowski metric. So we have minus 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. OK? And now the idea of Born-Einfeld is you instead, I mean, if you wish to consider the volume element, you would take the square root of minus the determinant of G. And so instead of that, what you do, you define this to be minus the determinant of minus the square root, sorry, of the determinant of G plus F. Okay? So without F, you would have the volume element of the space in the Minkowski space, and then the idea was to consider this as the symmetric part and this as the skew symmetric part of the same tensor, and you take this kind of generalized volume. And if you do the computation right, you get this. So that's the variational origin of the BI equation. So the first thing you can see that it is related to Maxwell equation because if for weak fields, so EB small, then we see that up to a constant which doesn't play any role, the leading term would be exactly L will behave that like minus 1 plus B squared minus B squared over 2, right? So then we get the Maxwell equation is exactly BI for very weak fields. Yeah, you have this condition and this one to take into account. Yes. So one is this package. Okay, but before, I mean, I will show you the computation in a moment. But the important thing is the motivation of Born and Infeld was to obtain for a charged particle a finite electric field. So I will see that in a moment. But what I would like to emphasize, because it's one of the theme of the workshop, is that there is a lot of geometrical content. And we can see that at least in two particular cases. So let's consider two particular cases. The first one is as the static case. In the static case, it means that you disregard the time variable, and you consistently you can disregard the B variable. So disregard T and B. So what do we get? Then the algebra is very simple. We get a minimization problem, which is just minimization of the integral of 1 minus e squared dx, subject to the constraint. Now, we don't care about this one, and we just get the curl of e equal to 0. So this basically means, that we can substitute a gradient for E in this formula. So we get of a scalar function. And this has a geometrical content because this is just this quantity is the area of the following set. T is equal to phi of x1, x2, x3. If I put this surface in the space R4, time and space with this metric, this signature. So minus 1 for the time and plus for the space. And you compute the area of this surface and you get exactly this. So it means that in the static case, the Born-Infeld equation already describes some minimal surfaces. Okay. As a matter of fact, there is a particular case, and you can look for a radial solution. And after a few calculations, you see that if I write the electric field in a scalar way, then I will find a solution like this. That's quite simple to do. And you see that for large value of R, this behaves like 1 over R2. And so this would be the classical electric field of a point particle. Right? In the Coulomb, traditional Coulomb setting. And so what the Born-Infeld does, yes?
The T
Yes, I use, I mean, this is E is would be E of R divided by R. Okay? And so the you see that the Bonnefeld equation provides a cutoff for the field. So it's not smooth. I mean, only the modulus is smooth. This field is not smooth because at the origin it's not vanishing, so there is a singularity. And actually the divergence of E is not zero, it's a delta. Okay. No, it's not the divergence of E, it's actually the divergence of the dual variable, so that's confusing. Yes, and D is dL over D. That's the dual field, actually. And so here there is no B, so we should be here. Okay, and so this was the origin of the model. It was to, in order to fix the divergence of the electric field for a charged particle, Max Born got the idea of putting some square roots. I mean, this is very reminiscent of special relativity, where you have a square root in the Lagrangian in order to prevent the velocity to be more than the speed velocity. So here there is something similar for the electric field. So it's a kind of nonlinear cutoff in some sense. And you have this geometrical interpretation. So now there is another case where there is a second case, which is the case of one space dependence, which is also interesting to look at. So now the time is back, t is back, but we assume that for instance the two first special derivatives are zero. And now we can look at the constraints. So for the divergence-free constraint, we see that d3 of b3 is zero. And from the evolution equation, we see that the first component of dt b1 plus, so minus d3 of b2 is zero. And for the second component, we get plus d3 of b1 is zero. And for the last component, d2 of b3 is zero. So if we if I introduce S as a new name for the x3 variable, I see that b3 can be considered as a constant, so I can take it to be zero, for instance. So this is a consistent choice. And actually, E3 never occurs in the constraint, so in my variational principle, I can also consider that E3 is zero. So this is also consistent. Right? And now we can look at the equation we get out of that. So first of all, looking at these two equations, we see that we can find a potential. We can find the two functions x1 and x2 depending on t and s. I remind you that s is the x3 variable, such that, so here there is a nobody stop me. This should be an e here. Okay, so from this equation, I see that B1 can be taken to be the S derivative of X1, B2 to be the S derivative of X2, E1 to be minus the T derivative of X2, and E2 to be the time derivative of X1. Okay, and this is exactly what means this equation. And therefore, now I have no constraint anymore, and I can plug that in the Lagrangian. And what do I get? I get L is minus the square root of 1 plus, well, B square is just the ds. Here there is also a mistake, ds. So it's just the square of the length of dx x. Now we have a minus E square, which is the minus the t square, and finally minus the E dot B. E dot B is the determinant, I mean the cross product of the two vectors, like this. And you can rewrite that, if you prefer, as in a more minus dtx square. square, and here you just add plus dtx dot dsx square. Okay, and this has a geometrical interpretation because if you now take the integral of that with respect to t and s, so let's do that. So now if I take dt ds integral, what do I get? I get the area. This is just the area. Of course, I didn't define the boundary of my integration, but this is the element of area of a surface. But now it's a two surface, which is parameterized by t and s, and the components are t x1 of t and s, x2 of t and s. And this two surface lives in the space R4 again, the same space as before, and with the same signature, minus, plus, plus, plus. And you compute the area of this surface, and you get this number. So we get another kind of, it's more like an extremal surface in that case, because the equation evolving x will be of hyperbolic nature and not of elliptic nature, but it's still in the, we get, again, an example of extremal surfaces. Okay, so you see that these equations have a lot of interesting a mix of physics and geometry in it. So it's, and now I would like to write them because I didn't do it so far. So as it is usual for the variation for a variational problem like this, what you get, the BI equation are the optimality equations. So we get, of course, we keep the constraint. And doing a little bit of algebra, we get the, in some sense, the dual equation. And so D is defined to be the partial derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to E, and B to be H to be minus the negative partial derivative of L with respect to B. Okay? And so now we have really to consider this equation as evolution equation. And so, and therefore, this writing is not so good because you see that the basic quantity should be B and D and not E and B. So we use a classical trick, what you know in the case of ordinary differential equation, which is to introduce a Hamiltonian. So then we define HdB to be the partial Legendre transform of L with respect to the E variable. And it turns out that the expression for H is even nicer than the one for L, because L is a little bit weird. We have this minus in the definition, which means that L is not defined for any values of E and B. And actually, this was the goal of Born and Liefeld, that is to prevent E to be too large. But for the Hamiltonian densities, it's a nice function without a singularity, and it is just given by 1 plus D squared plus B squared plus D cross B squared. That's the equation. And so now we can explicitly write the equation in a completely comprehensive way by plugging the values of E. So I will use that in a moment. So you get for E, use a notation which will be very useful later. So it's D over H plus B cross V, and we get for H minus B over H when you get plus and minus D cross V. So H is well defined, this is here, and so I have to tell you what is V, and this is a very important quantity for the discussion. So this is D cross B divided by H. So this defines the BI equation now without ambiguity, because we can put let's say 2 for that and 3 for this constitutive law. Okay. So what do we know about this equation now? So we have a set of evolution equation. So it can be shown this is a known result. So the system is hyperbolic. So which means that it is locally well posed, and actually you have local existence and uniqueness, local existence and uniqueness of smooth solution. But it has also a very nice property, is also linearly degenerate. So if you are not familiar with nonlinear hyperbolic equation, linearly degeneracy is a condition that makes your nonlinear system as close as possible to a linear system. And so basically it is a condition that formally prevents the occurrence of shock waves, because nonlinear system of evolution like this, where this is a first order system of PDE, right? There is no higher derivative than 1. And this system, usually they create shockwaves, discontinuity in finite time. The Lipschitz norm of the solution usually blows up in finite time. And so the linear degeneracy condition is a formal condition. It's a kind of non-resonance condition, if you wish, that prevents the apparition of shock. And actually, this has a good effect that at least for small initial data, you can expect to get global smooth solution. And actually, this was a conjecture for me a few months ago, but since that time, some people in Korea actually proved the results as a global smooth solution for, let's say, weak or small initial data. Okay, and so they use the machinery of nonlinear equation, because linear degeneracy is actually a kind of super null condition, if you know the terminology. So linear degeneracy, in roughly speaking, implies null conditions in the sense of Klein-Normann. And therefore, you can expect the global existence of smooth solutions for small data. And this is a very recent result. I mean, this is maybe 1 month by Chai and some collaborator. Okay. No, it's not yet published. Okay. So now I would like to deal with this was the title actually of the talk, about asymptotic analysis. Because we know that there are, for instance, we would like to compare solution of the BI equation to some limit case. So it could be like, for instance, the static situation, the one-dimensional situation, or some asymptotic analysis, some asymptotic behavior we get when you take very strong fields. So the asymptotic analysis, actually in my case, was motivated by the case of strong fields. Because if you play around with this equation, you can see, you can guess that when the fields are very strong, the solution of the BI equation are very concentrated. This is typical of linearly degenerate system. the solution, basically they cannot blow up in Lipschitz norm, so they have a tendency of trying to blow up in L infinity norm. So they concentrate. And therefore you can guess that the behavior of the Bornstein equation for strong fields should be like more like particles. So therefore the Bornstein equation would be another way to do a transition between wave and particles by playing with the strength of the field. Usually we go from waves to particle by stationary phase analysis by oscillations. But here this is more like a concentration phenomena which would do the transition. So this was the motivation. And so for asymptotic analysis there are many tools, of course, but there is one which is very simple and elegant for conservation laws, which is the relative entropy method. So this is just a name. And so let me, before that, I have to tell you something about the BI equation, because otherwise this would be not so easy to understand that. So I could say that here, motivated by the fact that the BI system admits an extra conservation law. Well, conservation law is a terrible jargon of nonlinear hyperbolic equation. It means any evolution equation written in divergence form. And so what is this evolution equation? Well, this is just the conservation of energy, physically speaking. And here, the energy is just the integral of the Hamiltonian density. So the Hamiltonian actually can be also seen as a energy density, if you wish. And we find the nice conservation law. The conservation of energy reads that H is transported by V. And V is just D cross B over H. Or if you prefer, you can say it in a different way. You can say that the transport of the energy is balanced by the flux of the pointing vector D cross B. And so you can write that this way by dividing by H. So D cross B is the pointing vector, actually. Pointing vector. And this is known to carry the energy, to be the flux of the energy. So we have an additional conservation law. And in the theory of hyperbolic equation, this is not a usual fact. I mean, if you have a random system of conservation laws, usually in higher dimension there will be no such additional conservation. This is a very strong constraint on the structure of the equation. But for most of the physical and geometrical application, you get this kind of extra conservation law. Okay. Maybe I can use something very clean, so I can use this one behind. Okay, and so what is the method? So this, we have a proposition which goes back at least to Constantin Dassermos. I mean, you can find it in his book. And so this is the following results. So assume that we have, a system of conservation law. Let me rewrite this way, in a symbolic way. A system of conservation law. With an additional conservation law that I write dt eta of u plus divergence of q of u is 0. So what does it mean? It means that any time you have a smooth solution to this equation, then the smooth solution will satisfy this extra conservation law where eta and q are some function of the flux G, okay, and where eta, so it's a scalar function. So here, this is a system of M with M components, and so eta will be typically a function defined on Rm and valued on R. It's a scalar function. It's called entropy. And Q is a function of Rm cross Rd, so X is in Rd, valued in the Rm. It's the entropy flux. Okay? So, okay, and so now the proposition is the following. So let U be a weak solution of this system. So let me give you, so this is conservation law of conservation law. And you don't ask the weak solution to satisfy this equation because you know there are some nonlinear process to go from U to eta of U. So for weak solution, it's not clear that you can get this equation exactly. So the only thing which is needed is that the time derivative of the integral of U, of eta of U, is decreasing. So this is the only thing we need. Okay? And so for simplicity, I assume there is no boundary, so this is a periodic in space. Period 1, for simplicity. Because I don't wish to bother with boundary condition. And let now U bar be a smooth approximate solution of conservation law in the sense that we have dt U bar plus divergence of g U bar is equal to R, where R is a rest, is an error term. And I ask U bar to satisfy the entropy conservation law consistently, which means that dt eta of U bar plus divergence of q U bar should be equal to the eta the derivative of eta computed at U bar time R. You know, this is like the gradient of eta with respect to U bar. Dot, this is a dot product in dot product in Rm. Okay? And then there is a very simple algebraic formula. So I did not ask actually the system to be hyperbolic at this level. This is just an identity. Then we get yes, but here, yes, that's right. So, and I put the inequality, and instead of an identity, I will have an inequality because of that only. Otherwise, it would be an inequality. So we get the following formula, that the time derivative of the so-called entropy, relative entropy of U with respect to U bar is less, and this less is only due to that. If you had the equality here, you would get an equality. And so the formula is, if I am correct, should be the gradient of the function eta prime of U bar time g of U U bar, dx, I have to explain the notation in a moment, minus, and here we should have eta, the second derivative of U bar, applied to once to the remainder, and to U minus U bar. Maybe there is a wrong sign here, but it doesn't matter so much. So this is the identity we get. Yes, now I should explain what is these two guys are, right? And so I will put that in this box. The relative entropy is just the Taylor expansion of eta with respect to U bar. So it's eta of U minus eta of U bar minus eta prime of U bar, U minus U bar. Right? And you do the same for G. So you just Taylor expand U minus U bar to this. So what this method is interesting? This identity, because if you are lucky, so eta will be a strictly convex function, and even more, a function with a convexity bounded away from 0 and plus infinity. So there is a constant alpha such that the second derivative of eta is between alpha and 1 over alpha. So it's nearly quadratic. And the second derivative of G is bounded, right, globally. So then it's very easy to deduce a stability result in L2 out of this result, because you see now that eta of u bar, the relative entropy, because of this definition, you know, this is a convex function. And therefore, this controls completely the u minus u bar square, because, I mean, this is like, sorry? No, it's I need the G and the Q. Yeah, you have to assume also nice property on Q. But actually, here I never use Q in this formula. So if you do the Taylor expansion, you see that this relative entropy is here. This is the gap between the convex function and the tangent, and therefore this is basically like U minus U squared. And even better, G, for the same reason, this is a Taylor expansion. So G will be bounded because of that by a constant till time eta. Eta of u bar. So now it means that if you know that u bar is smooth, has nice bound, this is like dt eta bounded by C divided by eta, and this can be easily bounded also, so you get something like dt of eta u bar less than a constant depending typically on the Lipschitz norm of u bar time eta of u bar plus, this should be an integral here, and the integral of r square, something like that. So then, which means that we have L2 stability of the solution about any smooth approximate. So it's stability with respect to any smooth approximate solution u bar. Right? Because it means that typically if you take u and u bar to be very close at time zero with a small remainder, then you will control that at least for finite time. It's not global stability in time. It's, you will get an exponential growth of the error, but it's under control. Okay, so this is a very well-known tool in conservation laws, but unfortunately, it's very seldom that we get such a nice property. And usually, in order to close the argument, you have to replace this global assumption by some L-infinity bound a priori on the solution U. So in order to use this trick, most of the time we need to prove some L-infinity assumption on U, which is could be bad, difficult for solution. But here we are lucky, because maybe I can use the transparency because I have only a trick to finish. Okay, because the problem is, if you compute the relative entropy of the Bornfeld equation, it's no good because of the square root. You know, these square roots will damage the estimate. So it doesn't seem to be possible to directly tackle the Bornfeld equation and to use this stability result. But there is a nice trick, which I think I found. I don't know, maybe it was already known, but which is a very simple observation, actually. It's very elementary. Yes. Okay. Oh. Oh, we have to wait. That's right.
No.
Sorry? Oh, wonderful. Wow. Okay. And so this is a little bit fuzzy, yes. Okay. So, yeah, any stick? No? There's no stick. You must have a stick, no? Yes, no, that will be okay. Okay, so this is a very simple statement. So here, up here, you have the Bornfeld equation written with this V variable. Actually, the curl can be written this way, B, tensor product of B by V minus V tensor of B, and blah, 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 blah. So you see a little bit the structure of the Maxwell equation if you get rid of these red terms, because you get essentially the Maxwell equation weighted by H. And so we have the additional conservation of energy here, but we have the conservation of momentum also. So here momentum is the pointing vector, actually. So it's not surprising that there is such a conservation law. This is conservation of the energy momentum tensor, but it has a very nice structure. It looks like that. So dt of hv plus the divergence of hv times v minus this and that. And so if you are a little bit familiar with fluid mechanics, you immediately recognize the inertial terms of fluid mechanics here for v. And also, if you know a little bit about MHD equation, this is a typical coupling between the velocity and the electromagnetic field, the magnetic field, let's say, in MHD equation. So we have this additional condition, and the idea is very simple now. We, instead of considering this constraint, which defines the Bornfeld equation, we disregard this constraint, and we look at the extended system, the augmented system of equation, which is now a 10 by 10 system of equation. So this is the augmented Bornfeld equation. And so they look like MHD. There are some miracles if you try to do the spectral analysis of the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix. You see that it's much simpler to do that for the large system than for the reduced system, which is quite amusing. There is another property which I couldn't miss because it's so strange, that the extended system has the classical Galilean invariance of fluid mechanics. Don't forget that we started from an electromagnetic equation which is fully consistent with special relativity, and therefore the Galilean transform of classical fluid mechanics are not allowed. They are wrong. But here, because we extended the system and we forgot about this algebraic constraint linking the variables, then if we shift the space variable by velocity u, then what we are left to do, you don't change h, b, and d, and we just change the velocity according to the Galileo's rule, nothing else. And this seems to be completely ridiculous nonsense, but it's not nonsense because this transform is not compatible with the algebraic constraint of the Bornfeld equation. So we have a relativistic equation, we lift it, and then it becomes a Galilean equation. So I don't know if it's known for some other relativistic equation. I did something wrong. So what's the relaxation time? What? It's time to stop. But no, because I mean, the key stuff is coming up. Can you listen to me? Oh, it's so full. Again? Like that? Oh, this reminds me, I mean, can I make a joke here? Yeah? Because I saw in some Air Canada flight, a very boring flight, this movie, The Core, about the loss of dynamo. And so there are three scientists. In the movie, there is an American scientist and a French scientist, which is very nice in the movie. But the first thing you see from this French scientist is the first picture is really trying to get a Coke or soft drink from a machine. And since it doesn't work, he's trying just to shoot in the machine. So come back. Okay. So let's say... Should I try like this? There's some vibration. Okay. So if you try to do the same game with the Maxwell equation, we don't get at all this structure. For instance, with the Maxwell equation, you get an equation like that, which has no Galilean invariance. And it seems this is not completely done, but up to rescaling, I'm almost sure that the Bornfeld equation is the only one that has this property. But from the analysis point of view, we can do the thing is that we get an extra conservation law. So now we have a 10 by 10 system. And so we should be finished. I mean, no possibility, no room for an extra conservation load. But that's not true. If we take this function eta, which this depends on dp, p is h of b, the pointing vector, divided by 2h, this is also there is a conservation law for that. So this is an entropy for the system in the sense of D'Affermo's theorem. And the nice thing is that the h function before was not a convex function of the unknown. It was just convex in the neighborhood of the origin. So it was not globally convex. And now we have a function which is globally convex and which up to the factor h is nearly quadratic. And the algebra, of course, we don't get that because of the factor h, but at least we get a very nice property. We get that the GUU bar, which is very important in this bound, is bounded by a constant, a purely numerical constant eta of UU bar, if we compute the relative entropy. So which means that you can do this this bound without using any assumption on U. So we can compare any weak solution with decaying entropy with a smooth solution without any bound on the solution. And so let me just observe that this seems to be a new entropy for the system, but actually if you look at the value of eta along the algebraic manifold where the original BI equation lives, which is defined by these two algebraic equations, well, you see that eta is just another definition of h, because d squared plus b squared plus p squared plus 1 squared is just the square of h. So it's h squared divided by 2h. So in some sense, we recycled the same entropy for the extended system. So now, the time, and so with that, with this tool, you can do rigorous analysis, and just finish by showing the most interesting asymptotic regime I can tell you is when you enhance the. I lost your pen. Can you see? Oh, yes, it's below the. You enhance in an asymmetric fashion B. Oh, it's terrible. It's vibrating like. So it looks like a. Yes. Okay, so you enhance B and D in a different way. And if you look at the formula, you see that if you do that, the scale of B will be lambda, a large number. So you don't change D. So H being the square root of 1 plus D squared plus B squared plus D cross B squared, you see that by this enhancing, we can disregard this term, and these are the important term. And dropping the lower order term, you get this system of equations. And this is an interesting system because it's completely integrable in the sense that this system describes vibrating strings in the following way. And so you can compare the Born-Mitchell equation to this system, which is integrable. And just to finish, because it's you need the formula maybe. But it's better. Yes, and so what is this system? What describes this system? So a typical situation is you take a collection of vertical strings, you know, parameterized by the horizontal space, like a harp, a three-dimensional harp, and you start playing, right? Right? And so these equations describe that, at least locally in time. That is, the B field is the strings will be the integral lines of the B field, and the P field will describe the displacement of the strings. So this limit system is integrable. This is the kind of result you can do without any a priori bound on these weak solutions. The big defect, I should have said that from the beginning, that we don't know if there are global weak solutions. But at least if we can find them, then it's very easy to compare them to this asymptotic regime because we don't need any estimates. So even if they are ghost solutions, but we can compare them without any penalty. Okay.